Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You are listening to the Dom and Colin podcast. My name is Colin, and I'm here with Dom. Dom, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing quite well. And today what we're going to be doing is talking about episode 4 of Survivor Philippines. And this is one of the most acclaimed episodes, I think, in recent memory. So this should be a good time.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of Survivor fans, like the diehard fans who've been watching since the beginning, who like to bash modern Survivor, say, you know, it's not what it was in its prime. But I think even they are in agreement with the rest of us that this was a fantastic episode, one of the best in a long while.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And just before we get into that, I would definitely not want to miss an opportunity to bring up that our Big Brother Megacast with Koss is coming up definitely sometime this week, guys. So, you know, it's been much anticipated, and it's been a while. Part one of that's going to be going up this week, which is going to be discussion about everyone who has won the game that is not named Dan and Will. And then Dan and Will, those two, as well as some other people who didn't win the game that are also very notable players, that's going to be coming up in part two.
Mainly much anticipated by you when you keep asking me if I finished editing it yet. But I get your point, yeah. We've been putting it off for a while, but we feel like, given that we only have a limited amount of time to get all this stuff done, this isn't a time-sensitive thing. We prefer to focus on getting the Survivor recaps done and up as soon as we can. And we understand that they have been late over the past few weeks. We're sorry for that, but you know, that shouldn't be a trend in the future.
Yeah, definitely. We're going to be working on turnaround time, too. I think I may start editing a little bit. Maybe. We'll see.
So if you notice depreciation in quality over the next few weeks, then that's going to be the cause of it.
If you notice a depreciation in me doing embarrassing things and actually making air with them, that's why. But definitely check that out, that Big Brother episode, and subscribe on iTunes if you don't want to miss it. And hey, if you like what we're doing here, it's free. We would love it if you would tell a friend who you also think might like the show. So Dom, I think we're good to get into Survivor if you're ready to start.
Yeah, sure.
All right, yeah. And so, like we said, this is one of the most, perhaps one of the most well-crafted episodes of all time. And so let's get right into that. And I think one of the things certainly worth discussing is the lack of discussion that there was at the beginning of this episode, which is there was no dialogue for a long time. What do you think about that?
Sometimes silence is more interesting than action. And I think we saw that being proved here. Like they had this fairly chilling open with the discordant music at the beginning, and nobody talked for about 90 seconds. And when they did talk, it wasn't immediately talking about something that just happened. It was just generic discussion about, we used to like put stuff on a fire or whatever. It wasn't like, it often is where it's sort of cheap thrills, like they immediately hit you with something that's interesting and then move on to some other big thing. And it's all very, it's designed for people with short attention spans. This was a very carefully crafted opening scene, and I loved it.
That's right. I actually went back and checked, and 90's not far off. It was 65 seconds of pure silence, and then they start talking about just take a break. We can't get this fire going. Let's take a break. And we talked about the symbolism when they lost their raft, which is like historically, you know, the term was coined by Boston Rob, the buffoon tribe, and Matt Singh's surely historically among the buffoon tribes, the greatest of all time. And we often see that they just can't get anything going at their camp either, and that's certainly the message that they've been trying to send, I think, for us about Matt Singh this season.
Yeah, I like that this was the first part of the episode as well. It really sort of set the tone for the rest of it. Like, if they had had some just mundane scene at Tandang or Campbell or something and then immediately transitioned into this, it would have felt kind of out of place. But I think the way they did it, it really showed that this was an episode about Matt Singh and about their failure.
Yeah, and more on Matt Singh and their failure coming up soon for sure. And actually, we get to see a little bit about Matt Singh and how they're responding to all this failure, because this is the first time we've seen it. You know, we've seen tribes get killed pre-merge, but even after three episodes, they still always have at least like, you know, five or six people left. These people are down to three on its day 9 into a game of Survivor. And, you know, Malcolm and Denise both have confessionals about how just disappointing and deflating it is, and Russell as well. And he's like, this is just crazy that all this is happening. And it's really interesting, I think, to get to see them all just kind of so upset about how this is, they've waited so long to come play on this show, and this is not at all how they planned on this happening.
Yeah, so last week we talked about how we thought the remaining members of Matt Singh, whoever they were going to be in a pretty good position game-wise going forward. And so that might not necessarily kind of coincide with what we see here, but we have to remember that this, like, even if this is a good outcome for them, firstly, they might not agree with that from their perspective. Like, there may be sort of things they're not seeing. They may just have a different perspective on the whole thing. And secondly, even if this is true, then it's better for them when they have a choice about whether they're in this position or not. Like, even though
right. They
should be glad about what's happening, just to some degree, that kind of feeling of helplessness which comes upon you when you realize that even if this is true, you're just being backed into it by like your own mistakes that you can't even control is like that's not a good feeling. You can't fault them for feeling that way.
Again, we talk about them being upset, and I would argue that at least from where they stand in the game moving forward, Malcolm and Denise right now are right where I would want to be, which is I would want, they're going to merge probably at 12 and not 14, but I think in a perfect world for them, they want to merge at 6, 6, and 2. And we talked about this last week, so if you're interested more in our reasoning for all of that, check out that episode. But yeah, again, I don't expect them to always be prioritizing their position in the game above that general feeling of, oh my God, we've yet to win a challenge. We've yet to do anything right.
Yeah, and they'd have to be making assumptions about exactly how things are going to play out for them to be confident that they're actually in a good position. And also, they have very little margin for error now. Like, if they lose one more challenge, then one of them is going home, presumably. I mean, you can debate to what degree the producers like to make things up on the fly and kind of shape the format of the game in order to prevent outcomes they don't like. But in general, we agree, I think, that things are planned out beforehand. And so if they lose a challenge now, then they're done, pretty much. And whichever one of them is still in the game has significantly less room to maneuver once they're absorbed into whatever new tribe they happen to end up in.
Yeah, and 6-6-1, I think, is while the one is still a fine position, two people is what you really want, I think, in a post-merge situation, yeah. And also, Malcolm being a big fan of the show that he is, he knows they sent Stephanie and Bobby John as a two-person tribe to tribal council. Like, they had Karor sit out 7 people from a challenge. It's not unprecedented stuff.
Right, and I think the conditions are taking a toll on them as well, because part of them not winning the immunities is because the immunities and rewards are combined this season. They haven't won any rewards either, so they don't have the usual comforts. Well, comforts is a relative term here, but stuff like a tarp or a good fishing gear or stuff like that, which just allows them some kind of respite from the conditions they're in.
That's right. We also got to be, exactly, all these other tribes have been scooping up rewards with, they've now each gotten 4 rewards. Tandang's got steak now every night, and they've got tarps for days and their sweet fishing gear. And Calabao just got their tarp and everything, and Matsing's just dying out there. And it's got to be deflating, I would imagine, knowing that everyone else is having a much better time than you.
Yeah, although Malcolm had an interesting secret scene where he said that even though he obviously acknowledged the downsides of having a two-person, three-person tribe now, there were some upsides. Like, he didn't have to worry about what people were talking about when he saw some conversation being carried on like 100 feet away or whatever. And he no longer had to get paranoid when somebody went off to get tree mail and somebody else, like, you couldn't see them or anything like that. It's a much more serene atmosphere where you're with only one or two other people, and they're people who, by virtue of having gone to tribal council and taken out everyone else, they're people that you've chosen to be there with you. So they're the people you're most naturally get on well with, and you're not having to distract yourself with these other people.
Oh, yeah, if history is any indication, a bigger tribe does not always equal better tribe. You need a bigger tribe that gets along.
Yeah, and we're seeing that play out with Tandang, which I think is a good segue into the scene that happens after the Open, where we see just this bizarre set of circumstances going down at Tandang. If you want to explain, if you want to go back over those quickly, and then we can get into them.
Yeah, sure. Well, Pete here wants to create some chaos. He takes a page out of the Russell Hant's handbook. And his quote, I think, was like, any chaos to create is going to be beneficial for me, which I think is an arguable thing, although if Russell's any indication, he seems to make it work for him. And the way Pete goes about doing this is he plants the idol clue in RC's bag. Now, go ahead.
Yeah, I was thinking about what he meant here, and this might just be me being pedantic, but when he said, any chaos I create is going to be beneficial for me, I'm not sure whether he was saying, okay, I'm going to create some chaos in a way that's beneficial for me, and I've carefully thought about what that's going to be so that I can predict the outcome, or if it's, I'm just going to mess things up as much as I can, and I assume that that's going to go well for me just because, well, I don't have a good reason, but that's my plan.
See, I got the impression that it was leaning towards the latter, although maybe that's just because Pete is, again, I can't shake that Pete is an engineering student, and he kind of knows what, it seems like he should know what he's doing.
Yeah, it seems like it always comes back to that, like in our season preview with Gordon Holmes and now you here. Like, whenever Pete does something stupid, it's always, but he's an engineering student. This must be part of some larger plan, but I'm not convinced that it is, to be honest.
Yeah, we've seen Pete do nothing but stupid stuff for the most part, but every single time it always goes back to that.
Yeah, and it's gratifying as a viewer to get to watch someone like him play the game, but if you think about what the consequences of a move like this are, I'm not convinced that they're wholly beneficial for him. Like, obviously in the short term, driving Abby away from RC and towards Pete is a good thing. I don't think anyone would deny that. But he knows at this point that a swap or merge is coming soon, and when he does that, he doesn't want RC and Skubin to be aware of their position at the bottom of the tribe, and he can tell that RC and Skubin are savvy gamers who are willing to make a move if they have to, and if that involves flipping on the remaining people in Tandang, then they're going to do that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I had the same kind of thought went through my head, because we see a result of this is Abby flips out on RC and says she betrayed her and she's broken her trust and everything, and RC spends much of her time this episode trying to get much of her time in many of these episodes with Ab and Maria trying to, like, mend these fences. And it seems like if they should be anticipating some kind of swap or merge or something coming up where staying unified, at least historically, has been a very good thing for tribes, and it's something that they would, a goal they might have. So I'm not so sure why Pete might find this to be such a great plan, where it's splitting up the people that you're hoping to rely on for the near future in this game seems a bit premature to me.
Yeah, and I know we're both feeling bad for RC, and we're hopeful and confident that she can turn this around. But what did you make of her response to this whole situation with Abby?
I have kind of, again, two thoughts on this, which is, one, my first thought, honestly, is if she, which she genuinely did not put that clue in her bag, someone planted it, and she doesn't know what happened or why, but I feel like if she had never seen the clue before, she could make a much bigger deal out of it, like, oh, well, come on, someone's trying to set me up, I've never seen this before in my life, let's figure out what's going on here, which, again, may not be the greatest social tactic, but is better than kind of deflecting it. But I think her problem is that she has seen this clue before, it just wasn't in her bag. So if she tries to bring up, like, oh, this is news to me and everything, Abby can then immediately say, well, not really, we discussed this 2 days ago.
Yeah, and given that that information previously was only with Abby, then it makes RC look worse if that ever ends up being revealed. Because, so, like, currently her closest ally seems to be Skupin, and now if Skupin learns that she's been hiding this information from him the whole time, then that is not going to sit well with him. So... Mm-hmm. No matter what she does, she's in kind of a difficult spot. I thought her emphasis seemed to be getting back on good terms with Abby, which, yeah, you can kind of understand it. It's a good thing. Like, it speaks well of her as just a person and a player, that she wants to avoid needless confrontation and just get to the bottom of things. And if there is a problem or a misunderstanding, she just wants to resolve it so they can be friends again. And that's good. That's understandable. But at the same time, it might just be that Abby's a lost cause and she needs to devote her efforts to, like, working over people like Lisa or Artis, or just coming up with some other plan and just ditching the whole idea that Abby's going to be a potential ally for her.
Yeah, I think she needs to definitely be working on every other relationship, like cultivating any relationships possible on that Tandang tribe, and then start focusing on trying to get Abby back. But for the time being, I think you're right that chasing around Abby and trying to make things work with her, and I don't know why she's doing that. Perhaps she feels like it's a 50-50 shot of who's coming off worse to the rest of the tribe or who's going to come off worse on TV, or maybe she feels like she's at fault or something. I don't know.
Yeah, we saw that scene where RC was bemoaning the whole situation to Lisa, and Lisa, as someone who seems perfectly calm and well-adjusted in her own right, I imagine very sympathetic towards RC there, even though maybe they disagreed about the facts of the situation. Like, I think Lisa bought the story that Pete and Abby were feeding her about that. But even so, I think she recognizes that Abby is not a sane person, to put it mildly. And we saw in a previous episode Pete talking to Lisa and trying to bring her into the fold. And it seems, judging by his actions and Abby's actions, they think they've got Artis as well, although we haven't been shown the reason that they think that.
Abby Maria, to me, is kind of like Colton was last season, or like Russell his first couple times, where it's like, for whatever reason, they just have this massive effect on, like, not for whatever reason they have an effect on their tribe, but it is effective, and people are willing to listen to them and, like, bend their will and try to please them. And it astounds me that it seems like everyone kind of is collectively like, oh my God, this person's so annoying to have around. But at the same time, they all kind of listen to him and act like they don't have any other choice. Like, there aren't four other people that they could be dealing with.
I don't think that's it. I think that people like Colton and Russell played, as Gary categorized Dan's game in Big Brother 14, a much more kind of aggressive blitzkrieg game where they just bulldoze over everyone and don't really give anyone else a chance to put up any kind of resistance. Whereas with Abby, I think the only reason that appears to be the case here is that we haven't seen that being tested yet. Like, they haven't had to go to tribal. And so if they go to tribal and she manages to survive that and this kind of reign of awkward terror continues, then sure, that might be a fair description, but at the moment I think she's more like Naonka or someone like that, where it's just spazzing out in every direction, and people haven't had a chance to really acclimatize to it yet.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily mean to indicate that she has the kind of control over her tribe that I would say Russell and Colton did, but I just have, like, these scenes that stick out in my mind. Like, in episode one of Samoa, Russell's, like, wading in the water, talking to, like, Ashley Traynor or something about how it has to be Marisa. And Ashley's like, well, I don't really know about that. And he's like, it's got to be her. And people just kind of go with it. And it's just, it's kind of like a survivor phenomenon that I've never understood.
Well, I don't think it's difficult to understand on, like, a psychological level. I think it's just, you're out there, no one really knows what's going on. It's, for a lot of people, it's an experience which has no analog in their day-to-day life. So even leaving aside the game aspect of it, it's just a very disconcerting thing to be going through. And so when you're out there, you're kind of confused, you don't know what's going on, and you're introduced into this cutthroat social experiment, which, again, is, I mean, it bears some resemblance to, like, political life, office life, or whatever, but it's a much more amplified version of that. You're thrown into this whole thing, and now when someone comes up to you and gives you an easy solution, so if you vote for this person, you're not going to be the first out. Everyone else is going to go with it. You don't have to put yourself out there at all. It's very easy to just sign up for that and go along with it. And I think a lot of people like Russell have realized that, and when they're able to be assertive like that, it really helps set up their game just right from the outset.
It seems like the strategy is kind of like some of these 24-hour news networks where it's like they break a story on their morning show and then report it on their afternoon and evening shows, like, oh, everyone's talking about this now. When it just originated right there, but now it's news because they're saying it's news.
Yeah, it's a self-fulfilling thing. Like, if you think everyone else is wants this person out, and everyone else also thinks everyone else wants this person out, then it is indeed true that everybody thinks that person needs to go. So it's, yeah, that, and we saw this season actually with RC and Scoopin, where RC approaches Scoopin on day one, and Scoopin, who, yeah, isn't a newbie to this whole experience now. He's this isn't his first rodeo. But he seems to be operating under the same principle, which is, I don't want to put myself out there this early. Something's being offered to me, and it doesn't seem completely unreasonable, so I'm just going to go with it.
Yeah, definitely. We saw him like, well, it's a start, I think, was his response to it.
Yeah, sure. But yeah. I don't... The first week, I don't think anyone is assuming that what they have is necessarily that concrete, but it's just, like, it's an easy way out of that temporary situation, and then it gives those other players, like, another 3 or 6 days to cement those bonds and make it into something that's more long-lasting.
Yeah, I think when you're Scooping in that spot, you can kind of predict that you're going to be around for a little bit for the most part. So before we move on from Tandang, one thing I actually want to talk about a little bit is what we think about Pete, because the Pete we're seeing on TV kind of seems like this Brian Heidick wannabe junior kind of thing. Do you think that's how he's kind of coming across to his tribesmates or what?
I don't know. If you remember a few weeks ago, we said that when Pete was trying to bring Lisa in, the way he did it was just so transparent and so clearly lacking any kind of outward enthusiasm that it was a surprise that Lisa went for it at all. And this happened again this week. Like, when RC was questioning him about whether he knew anything about the whole thing with Abby, like, his demeanor made it clear that he knew exactly what was going on and didn't give a single fuck what RC thought about it. I think by this point, the connection between Abby and Pete had already become really obvious to everyone else, so there wasn't a point in trying to hide it. But I'm more willing to criticize him for it than I am to criticize someone like Malcolm for cutting out with Andrew or whatever, just because I think Malcolm kind of realizes that it's not the best thing to do for his game, but he just went with it anyway. Whereas with Pete, like, he's just trying to have his cake and eat it, basically. Although, if he wants to keep Abby as an ally, it's kind of awkward for him, because she seems like the kind of woman who's going to be very, very clingy, and the moment he kind of brushes her off in any way, she's going to interpret that as a sign that he just hates her or something.
Oh, Abby makes Danielle from Big Brother look completely sane. That's perhaps not an analogy that everyone's going to understand, but Abby Maria is fucking nuts, right?
Yeah, that's actually a really good comparison, although Danielle... If you didn't know about all of that stuff, if you just watched the show, then she comes across as quite sweet, whereas Abby Maria is just actively abrasive towards everybody.
Mm-hmm. One thing I actually wanted to point out was Pete, when RC was like, Pete, do you know what's happening with Abby? What's going on here? And he was like, I have no idea. And then it somehow became, like, really abrasive toward her. It's like, yeah, just believe what you want to believe. Like the Ronnie Talbot school of let it look like what it looks like. I feel like he could have handled that situation much better, because it looked to me like RC just wanted someone to be like, I have no idea what's wrong. I don't know why she's victimizing you like this. I feel horrible for you, RC.
Yeah. Going back to the Brian Heideck comparison you made, before the season started, I think a lot of people pegged Malcolm as the over-aggressive player, douchebag frat boy of the season, who would think that he was running the show and everything, be very, really cocky about it in confessionals, and then end up probably getting blindsided ignominiously or losing a jury vote somehow. But it seems like all those expectations have now been transferred to Pete, and Malcolm is the one who seems like a sympathetic character who's really nice, very, you know, someone who the audience really wants to root for, whereas Pete, I think we both agreed before the season, we didn't expect much from him in terms of positive stuff, but in general, we just didn't really pay much attention to him, but now he's forcing everyone to pay attention to him. He's really inserting himself into the season in a big way.
Oh, totally. And if I can touch on, I think Malcolm is a lot like what I was expecting him to be like. And you're right that there were a lot of people who were hoping he was going to be this super cutthroat guy, like, you know, like a much more talented version of Matt Quinlan, I think. But Malcolm is more to me, he's better than I was expecting, which is a high praise because I was expecting quite a bit, but he's much like what I was anticipating him being like. But Pete, like you mentioned, was someone who I thought was just going to be a non-factor and just we weren't going to see anything out of him. And the first couple episodes, we just got a couple pretty, you know, good little quips about Scoop and falling in the fire and whatever. And now Pete really is making himself a big player. And I think bravo to Pete, first of all, for making – I think Pete very much understands he's on TV, I guess is the point. And I think he's trying too hard, and I think it's coming across not nearly as organically as it does with, like, Russell or with Brian Heideck. It comes across a lot like Pete's trying to be the bad guy, but I appreciate the effort.
Yeah, it is very forced, which makes me wonder whether the stuff he says about him being in control and being the most powerful player in his tribe, whatever, do you think he's being sincere about that, or is this just hamming it up for TV?
I think he truly does really like his position. I think he does believe he's the most powerful person in the tribe.
Yeah, same. I think this is a reflection of what he actually thinks, but it's his manner in general which kind of turns people off and which makes it seem a lot more cocky and arrogant than maybe it really is. Because from his perspective, I can see why he might think that he's in control of things at the moment. And, you know, there are a lot of players in the past who have thought they were in control, but it turned out to be fleeting and they ended up losing it pretty quickly. And we wouldn't want to call all of them cocky and arrogant or whatever, but I think in Pete's case, that those descriptions certainly apply.
Who is in control of the Tandang tribe?
That's a good question. I'm tempted to say Lisa, actually, just because, like, she is the one who's going to decide which of the two pairs emerge triumphant, and to a lesser extent, Artis, although maybe I'm being slightly results-oriented about it, given that we've seen Lisa being portrayed as a swing vote, even though Artis is equally in that role, and the fact that they've portrayed her, not Artis, aside from the fact that she's Lisa Welchel and they want to show on TV, suggests to me that it's Lisa who's going to be making that decision eventually.
I agree with you that Lisa, I think, is going to be the one swinging. Were they, you know, if they even ever hypothetically have to go to tribal council and maybe say they rattle it all off and they're the final six, and maybe that's when we're going to be talking about this. I think the person in control, Mike Scoopin, and I'll tell you why. I think all it's going to take for Mike Scoopin to get RC, Artis, and Lisa to vote with him is to say, you know, guys, I really want to stay here. I really feel like we should take out one of Pete or Adam Maria. I think they're all four going to say, I would much rather go with Mike Scoopin than either of those two. I think that's all it's going to take. And for that reason, I think he's the one at the end of the day who, if they do end up having to somehow go to tribal council with the six of them, if he wants to stay, I think he could pretty easily stay.
Yeah, but note that that relies on him being able to get Lisa and Artis' support, which I agree that he will be able to if it comes down to that. But the fact that he's in a position to have to ask for it suggests that they are the ones who really hold the true power here. Now, this ties into to wider questions about the nature of control in the game like Survivor, where everyone on a theoretical level has equal influence, given that everyone has a one vote in a democratic process. But clearly, in practice, there are some people who have way more control over what actually goes down than other people. And you're right, I think Scoopin is maybe... it's difficult to know how good Scoopin actually is as a player, but I think on a tribe like this, when his competition is Pete and Abby, or rather, his competition is Pete, who is being tied down by Abby and having to keep her in check, I think it would be a much more competitive scenario if Pete has if Pete wasn't encumbered with an ally who was just completely off the reservation. Mm-hmm. But as it is, I think the duo of Scoopin and RC are going to easily be able to outmaneuver anything Pete and Abby can come up with.
So, last thing before we move on from Tandang, actually, why haven't we seen anything out of Mike Scoopin? What do we make about this?
Yeah, this is really odd. Like, this, we said last week, this was not what we were expecting from a male returning player who was brought back presumably because they wanted to show him again. Like, this is a great storyline. The guy who was taken out in this dramatic way in season two comes back 23 seasons later, the biggest ever gap for a returning player, and is now given a second chance. That's a fantastic inbuilt story to work with. And yet, he was completely invisible this episode. I mean, we saw brief snippets of him previously, but he was just nowhere to be found on Wednesday. So, I don't know. I think originally, I know we both pegged him as one of our top winner picks. I think that was a general consensus after the first episode. But now, I think it's going to be dropping way down those lists because this is not how... the question we always have to ask is, if this person were to win, how do we think they would be edited? Now, with some winners, they play an under-the-radar game or a game where they don't really reveal much of their thought process to the cameras, and so they give the editors less to work with. But with Mike, someone who seems to be a reasonably good narrator, someone who who, if he were to win, would play a pretty kind of assertive game, I would have thought, or at least one which is strategically interesting and which can be made to appear that way, and someone who has this prepackaged narrative for the editors to play with, if he were to win, his edit would not be at any point like this, I don't think.
Yep, and for that reason, Dom, completely out the window for me. I don't see how he wins.
Yeah. The theory I've heard is that maybe he's kind of like Bob was, where he had this great first episode and then dipped under the radar until the merge, at which point his edit started picking back up again. But I just don't see it.
I'd buy that if it was a first-time player like Bob, but not when it's a returner.
The other comparison I've heard is with Fabio, where, and this ties into the Bob comparison, I think the logic there is that both of them, they were never really in control at any point, so it's difficult to frame the way the game progressed to make it look as if they were. So it was more like, oh, this is just like a nice person who provides comic relief or is a good person to root for depending on who they are, and then their role in the game isn't really emphasized that much, and so when that's relevant, like at the big points in the game, they're not really anywhere to be found. But it just seems very circuitous to me. I don't think that's a credible theory at this point.
Yeah, I don't think so either, and I'm disappointed by that. I mean, who knows? Maybe we'll start seeing a lot more out of Scoopin. But I think if we don't start seeing more out of him very, very soon, he's going to not be showing up in my first-place equity breakdowns.
Yeah, like let's say next episode, if Tandang go to Tribal Council and Scoopin is very visible because he plays a big role, presumably whatever goes down, then maybe we could start putting him back up the list. The argument I suppose you would make is that since they haven't had to go to Tribal Council yet, there hasn't been anything for him to comment on, but there has been stuff for them to comment on, which is why I think Tandang has had a lot more airtime than Calibor has, which is we have all this psychodrama being played out, and we see RC comment on it because she's involved, we see Abby comment on it because she's involved, but we've heard more from Lisa about it than we have from Scoopin, which makes me think that the signs aren't pointing in the right direction for him.
Yeah, exactly. We've seen plenty of Tandang, just none of Scoopin.
Yeah, at this point, he's on level playing field with Artis in terms of visibility.
Yeah, well, all right, let's move from Tandang now. Let's move on to Calibau. And, you know, there's not a ton of to talk about again. Once again from Calibau. It's more of the Kent and Penner show, although this is yet another, I would say, some more very solid stuff between Jeff Kent and Jonathan Penner. And it starts out when Kent's talking about how, you know, most of the people on the tribe are these young people. He's got Dawson and Katie and Carter there with him and Dana, who he's not necessarily going to be getting along that great with. But then there's this other older guy, Penner, who is an adult and can carry an adult conversation, and he likes that he's trying around camp. And there's a lot of, and you know, he notes, of course, Penner also has the idol, so this perhaps could be another reason why his opinion's changing. But he talks a lot about having to, like, adapt and make adjustments basically based on his circumstance, which, again, and I keep saying this every single week, I keep liking Jeff Kent more and more. I think he makes this week some extremely good general points about Survivor, you have to – adaptability is king, like we've said basically from the beginning on this podcast, that's the number one asset, and I'm seeing a lot of that out of Jeff Kent.
Yeah, definitely. And that line about Penner being able to carry on a professional conversation, I think, is really crucial. Like, it's easy to say that this person should team up with this person or whatever, but when you can just not engage with them on any level whatsoever, whether on a game level or a personal level, it becomes very difficult to have that confidence that if you try to incorporate them into your plan, that things are going to work out the way that you want them to. And when you have someone like Penner, who admittedly is a big variable, he's someone who plays somewhat erratically, he's a bit of an emotional player, and he has the idol, and he's... So, for looking at it in that regard, it's a very, quote-unquote, risky move to try and have this deal with Penner, but at the same time, I don't see that it's any less risky from his perspective when he's making it than to try and get into the minds of someone like Dawson or Katie when they won't open up to him.
That's right, yeah. Like you will pointed out quite masterfully on Cook Islands, Penner's the kind of guy you want around because if you know what information he has at his disposal, you can predict with great accuracy how he's going to respond.
Yeah.
So we see. Yeah, it's extremely important.
Right. And that may be because pre-show we thought that Penner and Jeff Kent would come after each other, and that whichever one of them emerged victorious from that struggle would be the one in control of the tribe. But I think maybe something that we missed was that firstly there would be this dynamic where these two are the only older people on this tribe. They have, I think, both 20 years each over some of the other players. So there isn't much room for them to relate to other people in the tribe except for each other. And that plays a big factor in how the alliances form, particularly in the early days when you're basing everything upon these very short conversations. I'm enjoying them as a duo a lot more than I would have expected, and I'm enjoying Jeff Kent as a player much more than I would have expected to. Okay, so now this whole subplot gets developed when we see this tall, blonde, giraffe-like creature walk down to the beach, and this turns out to be someone named Carter, who is apparently a contestant on this season.
It was nice to see him.
Yeah, and we quickly learn why he hasn't been visible this season, because he is incredibly boring.
He was like, even when talking to Penner, and Penner's like trying to make this great bond and alliance with him, he's like, so listen, you seem like a kid who wants to play a straight-up game, and he's doing his Penner thing, and he's great diction, which of course is always appreciated. And Carter's like, I do want to play a straight-up game. I want to go far with you. He's like an 8-year-old.
I think Penner, both as someone who's been on the show twice before and as someone who works in TV professionally, is very aware of how to like break the fourth wall and how to convey things to the audience. He's very aware of his camera presence. And so when he's doing stuff like this, he's thinking about how this is going to be chopped down and edited as a TV segment to be shown to the viewers. And so I think when he thinks about what he's going to say to Carter here, he has that in mind. So he launches this grand pitch, which is perfectly tuned and well-timed and stuff. And then Carter's like, yeah, dude, that sounds like a really good idea.
I remember, you know, talking to Gordon before the show, and he said to Jeff Probst, like, I just don't see what you guys saw in Carter in casting him. I'm with Gordon on this one. I'm not with Probst. I stand with Gordon. I have no idea what Carter is doing on this show.
Yeah, to say a few words in his defense quickly, I think it's maybe that his natural personality is what they saw in casting, where he's maybe more animated or whatever they saw, I don't know. But then when he gets out and he's in this really unfamiliar world, he kind of goes back into shell. And I think that's a natural response for a lot of people who maybe appear extroverted but are more naturally introverted. I don't know.
I just feel like if his goal since he's graduated college was to be on Survivor, he would understand and be more aware of the TV show aspect of it and more... I feel like for someone who, if your goal is to be on Survivor, you probably during the interview process played up a lot of stuff because you are aware that that's probably what you're going to have to do to get cast on Survivor. And maybe he wants to be a returning player, and it seems like he would want to kind of play up and be a character on the show he's wanted to be on rather than just sit in the background the whole time. Well, maybe he's just stage fright now that he's actually out there.
Well, again, what we're seeing is the compilation of 16 or 18 people's stories, and when you're out there, all you have perfect knowledge of is your own story. So from Carter's perspective, he probably is thinking that he is playing a pivotal role in the season at this point. That may be what he's seeing from whatever he's seen play out on his own tribe that just hasn't been shown to the viewers yet. So for him, Carter's story is an interesting one, one which the viewers can relate to and take interest in. He presumably is mildly disconcerted, to say the least, by the way he's been edited so far.
Yeah, definitely. Now, in making this alliance with Jeff Kent and now with Carter, this is some pretty good work here. This was some strong stuff by Penner for this episode because it looked like he was going to be the one who was locked on if this thing is legit. However, some news has broken, which is that when doing this handshake by the boat and it was not pointed out by a highlight, like a little flash or any kind of confessional from Jeff Pent, apparently two fingers were noticeably sticking out. Now, what do we make of this?
So, on like the level of Jeff Gendt handshake gradation, is this, how much worse is this than a four-finger handshake? Is it better than a two-finger handshake? Like, what was the scoop here?
I mean, he's getting really low on fingers. I feel like Penner's going to start noticing at some point.
Well, what happens when he runs out of fingers and it's just like he just sticks out his fist?
Yeah, they go from pinky. Yeah, they eventually go to pinky swear to fist bump. The terrorist fist bump is, yeah, no, I don't know what to make of it, because it seemed like we were being shown that this was going to be a legitimate thing, but if footage is to be believed, and maybe they were just playing up his four-finger handshake for last time, and maybe that one was legit too, I don't know. I think maybe we could see Penner in for a rude awakening at some point still.
Yeah, sure, although they haven't given us much reason to believe that what they showed this episode was insincere. So, and it would make sense for it to be sincere, just from like a game logic perspective. So I have no reason to doubt that it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and basically the only other stuff that we saw at Calabao was this, the girls saying, oh, those guys are out there talking about us.
Yeah, do you think anything important is going to come of that? Or is this just a cheap way to get some suspense in an otherwise fairly unremarkable scene?
No, they are continuing to get galooed beyond belief.
Yeah. So what do you think will happen if they ever do go to tribal then? Do you think one of the girls will just fold and then agree to vote out one of the others? Or what?
Yeah, I think that's probably the most likely situation. I don't know how it's going to happen or what, but I think Dawson or Katie was going to be the one that's going to end up going.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, actually, because we saw Jeff, Ken, and Dana have some kind of thing going on originally, and in one of this episode's secret scenes, Dana said that she still likes Jeff Ken and wants to work with him if possible, but this is like a backup plan for her.
Okay.
So I guess it leads on to the next question, which is, like we said, we don't think there's much going to come of this, but what do we think this says about Dana? Now, originally I thought she's just trying to remove all her competition for the other women in the tribe, and that competition is the other blonde lesbian in the form of Carter, but do you think she's actually showing some strategic chops here?
Yeah, I mean, she seems to be at least keeping her options open. I think she's got great ways to connect with both the men and the women.
Yeah, during that scene when Dana was suggesting this Women's Alliance, you could see Dawson reacting noticeably as if she didn't really like what she was hearing, which makes you think that she's the one that's going to lead to this collapsing and that Dana's going to try and bring it together, it's not going to work, and then Dana's going to gradually drift back towards Jeff Gant, and Katie's probably going to be the first one gone.
Mm. Yeah, I could see that. I could see even Katie getting voted out unanimously.
Yeah, although, if you think back to what Jonathan said, where he said, and quite right here, I think, that if he took Carter and Katie to the finals, that he would win just because they're not going to be able to make good arguments for themselves, and they wouldn't have good achievements upon which to make any such arguments. Maybe Penner, if he's thinking long-term, tries to keep Katie around?
I don't know. I don't think so. I really don't. I think that's too much.
Yeah, I think with Penner, he's going to say a lot of stuff like that, and depending on what the editors choose to include, we're going to have a very different picture of what he actually thinks. So he's probably said the same kind of thing about Dawson, about Dana, maybe even about Jeff Ken. Who knows?
Yeah, and I just want to say, before we get off of Calabao for a little while, Penner has not lost his step whatsoever, I don't think, in front of the cameras. I think he's done a great job as kind of that narrator this year again.
Yeah. As we said before, we thought he'd been almost neutralized by the fact that his whole story was devoted to looking for the idol, but now that he's found it, he's able to get back into his stride again. I like what we've been seeing of Penner in recent episodes.
Yeah, definitely. So let's move on now. I think let's talk about the pathetic Matsing tribe. And I feel bad calling them the pathetic Matsing tribe. I guess that's very results-oriented, because I very much like the people on the Matsing tribe for the most part. Although I would agree with Malcolm, who has a quote that in this episode where he says, "You could tell from day one that Russell lacked self-awareness," which I would say is quite on point. And this is something that we're definitely going to be hitting on later, but this is the kind of a running theme here, and it's very interesting to see this from a returning player. And it's once again another I think something people, when, you know, seasons down the line from this, people are going to look back and say, oh, that whole Russell Swan experiment, maybe not such a great idea.
Yeah, leaving aside Russell in Redemption Island, who I think we both agree is kind of an outlier, do we think Russell Swan has put up the worst performance as a returning player when it's been veterans against a whole cast of newbies and not fans versus favorites?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Stephanie was drawing dead to win pretty soon after the merge, but Russell Swan was drawing dead to make the merge pretty early on, too, I guess. So.
Right, yeah. I think Stephanie at least had ways where, had she played it differently, she maybe had a few outs to win, whereas Russell, I don't think, was ever even in that conversation.
Yeah, I think part of the problem for Russell is, yes, he's a returning player, but no, he did not learn a damn thing from his first time playing it, it doesn't seem.
Yeah, so he gets all the disadvantages of being a returning player, i.e., the possible anti-veteran sentiment, the whole thing where if he goes up in front of a jury, people might think, well, yeah, we don't want to give it to someone who's played the game before or stuff like that. And yet he gets none of the positives, which are experience upon which to build a knowledge of the game that he can take into the season.
Well, we may be a bit quick for saying that, because he does point out with some great accuracy, neither one of these guys has said anything to me about where they want to go if the bottom falls out of this thing. And that makes me a little suspicious, which... He's doing something right, finally.
Drawing on an insight pun in by the great Susie Smith.
That's right, yeah. He's catching on. He's learning this game quickly.
Yeah, but if you think back to Samur, he only ever had to go to one tribal council. He has not had the experience of having to actively scramble and play the game in the same way that pretty much any other player, if you brought them back for another season. Yeah, like if you bring back someone like Ashley Trainer, she's going to have a greater base of experience upon which to grow as a player than Russell will, even though you would never even consider bringing back Ashley Trainer as one of your returning players in an otherwise all newbie season.
Yeah, she's Ashley Trainer getting some shout outs this episode.
Yeah. more than she could reasonably have expected to get.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about Russell now, because he wants to go looking for this hidden immunity idol, which, of course, is right under his nose, and we get the great, oh, it's right in front of him while he's looking montage, which he was very well, to his credit, was very well aware was going to happen if he didn't find the idol.
Yeah, although you can't really say that and set yourself up for it, because if you just hadn't said it, it might seem kind of cruel for the editors to make fun of him like that, but he just invited it by saying that this is going to happen to him.
That's a very good point. I didn't think about it like that. I was like, oh, that's kind of a heads-up play to make yourself not look like an idiot, and then... You make a very fair counter-argument.
It's like, if you're going to play a fake idol or something, and you say, well, or you're going to go to tribal council where you might be in danger and you don't play a real idol, you don't say, oh, well, if I get this wrong, I'm really going to look like an idiot, because if you get it wrong, and you do, you can be damn sure that quote is getting put in the episode.
That's right. Yeah, and of course, we all know that the incentive when playing Survivor is to look not as much like an idiot as possible.
Right.
Yeah. Speaking of looking like an idiot, when Denise walks up on him trying to look for the idol underneath, like, the camp thing, he tries to, like, lie his way out of it, which Denise is not buying. Now, I could see this working on someone dumb, but I think he's in the wrong camp to be trying to lie his way out of that.
Yeah, like we said before, Denise really gets it. You can't really pull a fast one on her.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess I like the effort, kind of, on Russell's part, because when you're that down to it, I guess is the way to put it, where there are three people left and an idol is now more than ever a hot commodity, especially when you feel like you're in the hot seat. You don't want to be alerting them, especially when you know that they may not have many clues.
Yeah. I think there might be an argument, if you don't expect there's a tie between Malcolm and Denise, to maybe try and look for it with her to try and cement you as the two are going to go forward if you have to go to tribal. But as it is, if you do expect that there's something between Malcolm and Denise, though, then I think you're screwed and you just have to go and look for it as hard as you can. And at that point, putting up a pretense of, oh, well, I'm just fixing the shot or whatever, it doesn't really matter. Like, Denise is going to see through it and she's not going to care particularly much.
Yeah, I don't even know is it an automatic thing where you have to kind of make up something? Because I feel like he may have gone, I think he probably could have just said, like, oh, yeah, I dropped something, or whatever, I dropped something. He doesn't need to go up and then explain it again. Oh, yeah, so the reason I was down there was, I feel like that's going past the clothes.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of in Breaking Bad when Walter's trying to explain the second cell phone to Skyler.
Yeah.
If that makes sense, where he If he just shut up about it, she probably wouldn't expect that much, and she would buy his initial explanation. But then when he goes up and Connie says, oh, and really puts it on thick, it becomes so transparent that it's hard not to see through it.
Right, yeah. Okay, so do we want to move on now, I think, to the immunity challenge? Because this is some fantastic stuff if you're ready to get to it.
On to hashtag immunity challenge. Yeah,
hashtag immunity challenge, that's right. This is good stuff. I'll say this might be the greatest pre-merge challenge I think I've ever seen. I think the end sequence of this, I don't think I've ever been as, like, captivated by a challenge. Is that too bold for you?
I'm too forgetful and lazy to go back through all the pre-merge challenges and assess that statement, but the fact that no other one immediately springs to mind suggests that I'd probably agree with you.
Well, I think the point kind of is, and there was an article written about how fantastically this episode was edited, because what the editors really got to work with for the first four episodes is Matt Singh loses every single time. And what they ended up getting as an audience response, at least for me, is I was on the edge of my seat rooting for Matt Singh, and I don't even care that much about Matt Singh. Like, I know if they lose, Russell Swan's going to go, and I kind of want Russell Swan to go. But at the same time, like, I was so invested in the frustration that all of them were feeling, and I wanted to see them finally get a win and pull it out. And, you know, I liked that they were literally dragging themselves through the mud trying to get something to happen for this tribe. And, you know, also I definitely want to see these other tribes go to tribal council. But I thought this was just absolutely gripping stuff.
Yeah, there have been so many times in previous seasons where in the next week on Survivor segment or whatever, they put in these kind of forced, canned little things to create suspense. Like, oh, what's going to happen here? Is this person going to win immunity or whatever? And no one ever really buys those, and they just cheapen the episode. But here, like, there was this genuine question in everyone's mind of, is Matt Singh going to continue to lose or not? And the editors did a great job of managing to get us personally invested in Matt Singh's success or failure.
Yeah, and I think they're historically, I think, you know, some of the people that we talk about not being such great fans of the newer seasons compared to the old ones is there's now a lot more, I think, like, gimmicky stuff that does kind of cheapen some episodes, and I don't think that was the case at all with this. Like, the intro shot going to the immunity challenge was like a slow pan over, like, the jungle, and then it sped up and, like, some intense music started playing and it zoomed right in on the challenge, and it really got you, like, focused and, like, oh my god, this is a big moment. And I thought it was just, like, really well done stuff, and a far cry from some of the stuff that I think has brought the show down a bit.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that, actually. That intro shot was fantastic.
Yeah.
I can't really convey in words what I thought about it, but just when watching it, that was brilliant.
As was, and not to skip too far ahead into the challenge, but that final pot smashing for Jeff Kent, like, backdooring it, was just beautifully done.
Well, we can sit to that if you want, because I think that was, like, the real focal point of the challenge.
Yeah, I think it's probably worth mentioning that each tribe had the men run it, but that's about it, because it seemed like there was a pretty big advantage for long legs.
Yeah, and artists noticeably doing good work in the second portion.
That's right. Artists putting in light work there, shipping first place and steak dinner.
But not given a chance to say anything about it, or anything else for that matter, but just silently there doing his thing.
He's regulating, dude. That's all it is. He's a silent killer. So let's talk about this pot smashing, though, because Malcolm got Matt Singh a nice lead, and Russell maintained it, and then Denise, being a foot shorter than everyone else running in the competition, I think Mastermind Pete ended up passing her for Tandang before Artis started swinging at the pots. But still, Matt Singh was second on the pots, and so it looked like Calabao was going to be the ones going to Tribal Council. They were going to be the ones going to Tribal Council. But Jeff Kent, you know, this guy should have been an athlete or something, I'm telling you, Dom. He's great in these challenges.
Yeah, they did a fantastic job of building suspense when you consider that the final matchup that the whole challenge came down to was some random kid who seems pretty athletic in his own right, sure, against a former Major League Baseball player in a ball-throwing contest.
Yeah, in a contest of, like, who can best adjust to the velocity and momentum of this moving object.
Yeah, but like, it still managed to somehow make it interesting even down to the wire.
Yeah, well, the thing that bugged me kind of, and I felt like Malcolm maybe even blew this, is early on they were getting, like, I think Artis had one that smashed three pots or something ridiculous. They had, each of them had at least one that smashed two, and Artis was done pretty quickly before the other two. But Malcolm had two left and Jeff had four left, it seems like if you're Malcolm, you at that point start throwing straight and stop trying to go for the multiples and just go bang 1-2 just straight at the thing. And he still kept trying to arc it. And maybe he had to go around some of the obstacles that were in the way in the first place. I don't know. But if he didn't have to, it seemed like kind of a leak there.
Well, I wasn't really paying much attention to the physics of the challenge or whatever, but if you throw it straight, isn't there a chance that if the arc of the throw isn't perfectly constructed, it would hit the post underneath the ball and then fail to knock it off or go over the ball or something like that?
Oh, that's possible, actually. Because I feel like he was just coming at it basically straight, but just barely at a weird angle.
Although, I guess it's the same thing either way, because if you're doing it horizontally, then it still has to be... The ball that you throw still has to pass through that same narrow width of space.
Right, yeah, you're going for the same planes.
Yeah, just from left to right instead of vertically. So, yeah, you might have a point there.
Yeah, I don't know. It seemed, and maybe I'm wrong, because Jeff Kent did the same thing at the end, too. He just ended up hitting it first.
Yeah, but to come back to this final shot, so what we see is the usual thing where before the final ball is actually thrown, we see... Matt Singh throws one, and then Cannibal throws one, and it kind of gets repeated back and forth a bit with them missing. But then the final shot seems to be another one of those examples where Jeff throws the ball, and it loops back behind the target. And you think, okay, at this point, they're going to cut back to Malcolm throwing the winning ball or whatever. But then, in slow motion, the ball comes back out of the top of the shot and smashes the ball, and... And then immediately cut to Malcolm just looking completely despondent.
Oh my god, I felt so bad for Malcolm, man. He looked like he was ready to cry.
Yeah.
And I say that in not like a demeaning way at all. I mean, like, he looked like he was ready to just lose it. And speaking of losing it, Russell Swan, do we want to get into that?
Well, before we go on to that, quickly, do we want to be results oriented here and say that if they had kept Andrew, it wouldn't even have been competitive, this challenge?
People are going to say that, so we might as well, it's worth pointing out. If Angie's there instead of Russell Swan, they don't even get to start smashing pots. Yeah.
I mean, it's easy to make blanket criticisms of people being results-oriented, but at the same time, when people say, if you keep Andrew, then there are going to be challenges where she's going to have to physically exert herself somehow, and she's not going to be able to do it, and then one such challenge happens, you can't just dismiss that as a point in their favor.
Right. Oh, you results oriented, like assholes. Yeah, I would, if they had kept Angie and then both tribes, knowing that height was the big determining factor for those leg things, still chose to run all three men against Malcolm, Denise, and Angie. If I was Malcolm, it'd be like the guy on Price is Right who chooses to outbid you by $1 so you have to hit it like perfect. Like, come on, give me a chance here. Like, make this sporting.
Yeah. So we then get to what you mentioned, where Russell, Denise and Malcolm are obviously upset at the outcome. I mean, you could tell that, but they don't express it nearly as outwardly or forcefully as Russell does.
Oh, hang on. Before we do this, one joke I definitely don't want to miss is when Artis finishes first, he unfortunately did not offer to finish smashing the pots for either of the other teams.
Yeah, such a missed opportunity there. If Artis had done that, then he would catapult to the top of my favorites for this season.
Oh, he would be number one in my power rankings, for sure.
Anyone who is trolling Matt Singh, as cool as it would be right at the top for me.
Well, and also doing it with Tyson references, I mean, what more could you ask for?
Yeah, Artis clearly resembles Tyson, I mean, what? I have to anyone disagree.
Yeah. Alright, let's talk about Russell Swan here, because I thought this was more... fantastic editing, because I was sitting here watching this episode with my roommate, who has recently gotten into the show a couple seasons ago, and when they kind of cut to after the challenge and everything just went silent as they were showing the people walking around, there was no music, there was no Jeff, okay, everyone go back to camp, there was no pan out, montage, it was just silent, and everyone's standing there gasping for breath with their hands on their hips, and then Russell Swan starts talking, I said to my roommate, like, this has never happened, this is going to be some interesting stuff, and surely it was, this was... Russell starts having, like, this heart-to-heart with God, and it was really some of the more interesting stuff I've seen in a long time on the show. He starts talking about, like, why, Father? Why are you – what am I supposed to be learning from this? Like, this isn't – the point he keeps coming back to is, for me, this isn't supposed to happen. I'm a winner. Like, he feels like Hey, Probst starts getting into him, and he's like, you know, Russell, what are you doing? Where are you? Who are you talking to? God. And he's like, yes. And well, he's like, yes, Lord. He calls Jeff Probst Lord, which is a bit much.
An unfortunate slip there, because you know that Jeff is going to take that literally.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you're a returning player, Jeff is your Lord. When you're trying to solidify yourself in the call me back group. So back to Russell. This was kind of like this breakdown where it seems like he was all right. I guess what we can infer from this is he was okay with losing three, but three was like where he could, like, bad things happen in threes. And then when it becomes four, that's just enough. And I think he felt honestly like God had just stopped watching over him for whatever reason, because he felt, as he described it, he was like, when Jeff starts asking him, like, why do you feel, like, no offense, Russell, but sometimes you come across kind of entitled, and not to prove you right or anything, Jeff, but I was performed perfectly by God.
Yeah, I can't believe we didn't touch upon this last week when Russell talked about how his ancestors had gone through the horrors of Jim Crow and segregation and everything, and now this somehow culminates in Russell losing and surviving, as if the whole of African American history has a teleological purpose, and this is finally fulfilled in Russell being losing a challenge and getting voted out.
I think in his defense, he did say, "Now that was a lot more difficult than anything I've had to do here." But still, yeah, your point is right. I think to draw that comparison in the first place is a stretch.
But for someone, I mean, for anyone at all to pretend that their time on Survivor is part of some larger cosmic narrative, let alone Russell, who has just failed miserably on both of his seasons, is just ridiculous. And and my love for Denise grew even further this episode. And when I thought about the contrast between how Russell reacted to losing a challenge and getting voted out, and the way in which Denise reacted to potentially being voted out of tribal if it ended up being her, where Russell has faith in God, and Denise said she has faith in human beings, and displays possibly, I think, the best explicit attitude we've seen from a contestant in a long time, where she says, these are two good guys, and if they voted me out tonight, they played the game better than me. Now, we can question whether or not that latter statement is true, like it might have been a mistake from Malcolm or whatever, but the sentiment, I think, is spot on, and it's really something I love seeing. And of course, it's easy to say that at the time when there isn't really a serious threat to you. But if Denise is able to maintain this when she's been voted out or when she's on the jury or whatever, then yeah, I'll continue to admire her as much as I do now.
Oh yeah, I am totally in love with Denise. I love the quote about having faith in human beings, and not only that, it's I have to have faith in human beings, and that is exactly how I feel. Not to make this all about me. But Denise, yeah, I think that's the kind of perspective that makes Denise who she is, and that kind of, if you know, it could easily be me getting voted out tonight, and if so, that's not the end of the world for me. I understand that this is a game, and I hope that's not the case, but if it is, I'm not gonna, you know, hold any grudges or whatever. I understand people do what they have to do. And I think that is, of course, very worthy of applause within this, because that is, by no stretch what we see out of most people.
Right. When we think back to last week when Russell was entertaining the idea that he could possibly maybe get voted out, but of course it wasn't going to happen, the reasoning that he gave for why other people might want to do that is it would be, quote, a bold move to get rid of me because they want to get rid of a strong player. Yeah, like, keep telling yourself that, Russell. That you really hit the nail on the head there. Good job, buddy.
Yeah, there's a recurring character type on Survivor, the people that, regardless of when they go out, under whatever circumstances they go out under, it's, oh yeah, you know, I take it as a compliment. I think they viewed me as a big threat. There are people like that in Big Brother, too. Just every season, there are three or four of them that their sense of self is no matter how they'll ever go out, it was because people were too afraid of them winning.
Yeah, and there's an interesting, like, sub-archetype of these players who appear to base their jury votes on gameplay considerations, and who are the people who strategy-minded people like us like to praise as rational jurors, but who I think they base it on elevating their own eviction or their own being voted out as the most important move of the season because, well, they are the best player, and for somebody to get me out, it must have been some fantastic achievement. And then they base their vote upon who have the most involvement in that. And I think that's a criticism, for instance, a lot of people made about Matt Hoffman, in which I was kind of inclined to agree with before we had a chance to talk to him and realized that wasn't the case, but you see what I'm getting at, I think.
I do, yeah. Now, I don't fast forward through any of Survivor, but the time that I have most wanted to was during the Nicaragua reunion when Nayanka was talking about, oh, had I not quit, Yes, Jeff, I was in a fantastic position, and not only might I have won, I know I would have won. Which just strikes me as obviously just completely out of her mind, and it's that kind of stuff that I think is not what we're ever going to see out of Denise.
Yeah, if you start talking about the Nicaragua reunion anymore, I might have to go to Denise for therapy sessions, but I think that's a fine example.
Okay, well, let's purge that from our systems then. Okay. Yeah, so this vote was, again, a ton of, like, attempted misdirection, but I don't think anyone was really surprised. There was no real suspense. Actually, the surprise to me was that Russell voted for Malcolm. He really ended up buying into Denise, which I think is just more praise for Denise.
Yeah, actually, I haven't really thought about that, but, yeah, elaborate on that if you want.
Well, yeah, sure, because they both tried to convince him that he was the swing vote, which, now, hang on a minute. What if that's actually true? Like, I got some bad news for you. It's day 9. You'd probably have heard of this by now. But yeah, so he's thinking, okay, I'm the swing vote. And when he gets voted out, he was legit blindsided. He said he was blindsided in his final words. And you saw when the second vote came up for him, he was like, oh, really? Dang. But yeah, so he was sitting there thinking he's the swing vote and ends up voting with Denise. He's thinking Malcolm's going to be the one who gets voted out. And I would say job well done by Denise, because it seems like this automatic idea there would be, okay, well, if we do have to play more challenges, the thing he's been talking about is winning challenges, because losing challenges is why they're in such a bad spot in the first place. So you'd think he would go with keeping Malcolm, but instead, to vote Malcolm out with the intention of having Malcolm legitimately be the one gone, I think Denise deserves some praise for, granted, it wasn't an actual effort on her part.
Yeah, definitely. Although, it's worrying for Denise. Well, again, it's both good and bad for Denise that it was highlighted at this tribal council that she's just so eminently likable that if she were to touch the jury, then she would win almost unanimously. And the fact that Russell and Malcolm both acknowledge that in public, in one sense, it's validation that she is playing a fantastic game, one where, like, all she needs to do is make it to the end, and she possesses the kind of natural talents to make it there. But at the same time, if Malcolm is cognizant of this, is he really going to want to take it all the way to the end?
Well, who knows? And maybe that's what that foreshadowing I touched on last week was about.
Yeah, I could easily see the unresolved question going into the finale being, will Malcolm have what it takes to backstab Denise and claim the prize for himself? And that could play out either way, but I think that's definitely going to be a plot point if Malcolm and Denise are both there in the late game.
Yeah, well, let's talk about what we expect to happen, because I think we both very clearly do expect them to both be there, which I think to me means we expect there to not be three tribes anymore.
Yeah, so I guess the question here is, do we think there's going to be a swap next episode, or at what point do we think the merge is going to be? I know the questions are kind of related, so tackle them as one if you like.
Sure, yeah. Well, okay, because the big sweat was not this week for me who was going to get voted out. It was, at the end of this tribal council, are Malcolm and Denise going to have to vote in, or they're going to have to reach into a jar and grab a buff?
Yeah, when the last vote was cast for Russell and he got his torch snuffed, it was 1:53 for me, so 8:53 Eastern. But basically, the point is there was still potentially like 5 or 6 minutes that could be left in the episode. Obviously, there's a commercial break before the person who gets voted out final words and then the next time segment. But there was time for Jeff to take out a separate urn with two buffs in it, have both of them pick a buff and send it out to their new tribes. And that was something which was a serious possibility, I think.
Yep, and Dom, because that did not happen, color me stupid. I am the eternal optimist. I think we're going to see 3-3-1. I think they're both going to split Calabao and Tandang evenly, and Malcolm and Denise are going to go with a group of 3 and 3 from each, and Malcolm and Denise are going to get split into each of those two new tribes. And that's fantastic, and I think we're merging at 12.
So what's the basis for your optimism there?
Because they did not have them reach into a jar and pull a buff. However, now that I'm thinking about it, when thinking about the next time on Survivor, maybe it's because they want them to go get that idol first.
Well, it would also be kind of anticlimactic, I think, where you've already had this great ending to an episode, and now, oh, by the way, you're on new tribes. That's a momentous event in the course of the season, and it's something which I think you would want to save as part of the build-up for next episode.
Okay, that's possible. So do we want to... what do you think about how this is going to go down for a swap or whatever?
See, I think this is interesting because it's like a puzzle which you have to piece together based on the clues from the next time on Survivor segment. And the first of those clues is that they show Malcolm and Denise hunting for the idol. Now, if this is going to happen, if a swap is going to happen, it would have to be almost at the beginning of the episode, I think. So you would have the requisite, like, Matt saying after Tribal Council segment. But I don't think you'd have something like this where they just go searching for the idol or whatever unless one of them finds it. Now, the fact that the idol is in play makes me think that logistically they would have to swap, because let's say Malcolm finds the idol and Matt Singh lose again. Now, if they go to Tribal Council, presumably Malcolm can play his idol and then Denise automatically goes home. And if he can't play his idol, then showing him look for it and finding it and him having it in the first place becomes kind of pointless. So,
yeah, if he can't play his idol in that situation, why have it?
Yeah, that's probably the absolute worst outcome for production, because like when someone uses the idol, it's typically a big event. It's a blindside. It's drama. It's someone getting voted out when they didn't expect to be. When you can predict the outcome as soon as you know the outcome of the challenge because of the idol, then that takes away from the appeal of having the idol in the first place. So I think the fact that we're being shown this either suggests that they take that risk and neither of them finds it, or rather that maybe one of them finds it and they don't lose again. The fact that they're showing this means that either there is a swap, but at the same time, the fact that they're showing it is incongruent with there being a swap. And so it makes me think that they don't swap and neither of the bad outcomes happen.
Okay, I'm thinking that they do find, the reason that they're showing it is because they have to show them finding the idol. They would prefer to have shown it a previous time, but they couldn't because Russell Swan was still there. I think they're going to show them, the obligatory post-Tribal Council. The opening segment after the song is going to be them finding the idol, and then we're going to go into the merge after that, like we would normally go into a reward challenge, the second segment after the theme song.
Yeah. Okay. And now the second clue, which is kind of related to the first because it plays into the timing of the remaining episodes until the merge, is the possibility of a medevac.
Mm-hmm.
So in the preview, we see Jeff coming into a camp, which supposedly he doesn't do unless there is a serious possibility that someone's going to get taken out. And we see a shot of Jonathan looking pained, but usually shots like that are misdirection. And we see Jeff Kent holding his knee and clearly expressing agony. And again, usually when that happens, it's not so like blatant that it's that person going home. So if you see that, you think, well, it's probably not Jeff Kent or Penna. So there's been enough going on this season and enough to sustain like 42-minute episodes that if this wasn't needed, I don't think they would put it in. So the fact that they're showing it makes me think that there is actually some significance to it.
The fact that they're showing it makes me think that they don't want to clue us in that a swap is going to happen next time. They want it to be a surprise, and they're showing us the first two segments before the swap happens.
Well, didn't we see Jeff come into the Calabar camp? So either there is a swap, and both Kent and Penna and anyone else who we see observing it in the preview remain on the same tribe, or this happens before any potential swap.
I think this happens before the swap. I think the idol hunt and this are the only things that happen. Then we get a swap, and then it's a new game.
There's so much to cram into one episode, though.
I think they can do that. I think it's two segments and then a swap. One challenge.
But it would have to be idol hunt, medevac, and then swap, challenge, and then we need to see the new dynamics on both tribes, and then a focus on the dynamics of the losing tribe. How Malcolm and Denise fit into that. If they were to do that, then it would end up with everything being rushed, and they don't want that. I think, given how well they've crafted it the season so far, they've shown that they can handle this in a competent manner. They wouldn't want to place those structural constraints on themselves.
Okay, so over under 2.5 people switching tribes next episode.
Under.
I'll take the over.
But I think it's a mistake to frame it as like an over-under thing because it seems like it's a binary thing or a scenario with three outcomes, whatever the technical name of it is, where either nobody swaps or Malcolm and Denise get absorbed into new tribes or there's a big swap and everyone ends up in a new tribe.
Right, yeah. I'm giving you no swap or Malcolm and Denise only. Okay. I'm saying over 2.5.
Okay, well, I'm happy to take the under there.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll find out. Do we have anything else that we want to talk about today?
Just going back to the editing quickly, one thing that Coach has apparently said is that they have different teams of editors working on each episode, which makes me wonder whether, because we like to make predictions based on the edit because it's a fun puzzle to try and deconstruct. It makes you wonder, though, whether what we're reading into it is something which is actually there or whether it's something which we just want to assume is there because it fits into the story that we're trying to construct. Like, is there actually an element of continuity between the different editing teams and how they edit the show, or is are the differences just a result of individual editors and their own quirks?
I would say the fact that this is news to me is an indicator that there is a pattern that is seeable.
Yeah, I think they map out the general format of the season as a whole and how that plays into the construction of individual episodes. But at the same time, if this season might not be a great example, because I think everyone agrees that the season as a whole has been excellent, and there haven't really been any weak episodes so far. So that doesn't say much about the variance in editing at all. But I think it's more evident in some seasons than others.
Okay. Well, any examples that I might be able to draw? China, for instance. I feel like that was kind of a high variance one.
I guess maybe South Pacific, where obviously episodes like the Brandon episode are much more imposing than ones like, oh, Dawn and Whitney get voted out in a double boot. But at the same time, the editors can only really work with what they're given, and it's much easier to make a great episode out of Brandon gives up immunity and gets voted out than the Pagoin continues in its natural stages.
Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah, it's situational stuff. They put whoever did that Brandon episode, that was when I was thinking about up there with this episode. I think the Brandon episode is the last really notable one for me.
Okay. So just talking about what we think might happen, and we've spoken a lot about how we think Malcolm and Denise's fortunes in the game might change depending on when the merge is or whatever. So let's talk about the more format-based things, when we think the merge is going to be. So if there is a swap, we're committed to a merge at 12, yes?
Yes. I am.
My worry about there being a merge that early along with a swap is that the fact that they insult the audience's intelligence by this whole Tribe 1, Tribe 2, Tribe 3 thing suggests that they want the audience to kind of have this attachment to these individual tribes, and mixing them up in this confusing way to get two episodes worth of mileage out of it seems to defeat the whole purpose of that.
I don't subscribe to that, I don't think. I don't know how to counter-argue that, because it's just not... I think differently than that. I think we've seen it plenty of times where they're willing to swap them entirely for... people are going to be wearing different color buffs, 50-50, for two episodes, and then they're going to merge. They've done it many, many times.
In addition, I think on a returning player season, what they want is for that Clash of the Titans, if you like, to happen at the merge, because the merge is typically thought of as the big defining moment of the game. And so there are scenarios which are perfectly realistic, I think, where, for instance, let's say certain people within Calabar are in a minority after a swap, and Penna gets voted out pre-merge. Now, that takes away from a lot of the potential storylines that could unfold later in the season.
So maybe they say, now that Russell Swan is gone, they could conveniently do, okay, Penner, you're going to stay on Calabao. Scoopin, you're going to stay on Tandang. You're picking a woman from the opposite, from not on your own team. And then alternate like that.
Right, but again, I don't think they want to risk... Well, it comes back to the question of whether you think a lot of these things are planned out in advance. Because if Scoopin does appear to be in serious danger, then they might do that just to save Scoopin, if you think they're liable to do such things. But if they're not, then I don't see why they would want to introduce an element of variance into the game beyond that which already exists by having a swap and potentially having one of their two stars remaining in the game go out this early.
Mm-hmm. Well, they did a swap in Guatemala.
That's true, but if you look at how that swap was done, then it was done in such a way that Stephanie was always going to be in the majority. And you'd argue maybe they could do the same thing here, but I think logistically that would be a lot harder to do, given you have Malcolm and Denise potentially throwing a wrench into things and just everything like that.
All right, that's fair enough. Yeah, I think, honestly, I have no idea what we're going to see next week. I don't think we've even begun to see the surface of what they're going to be showing us. I don't think the previous Leon is going to have any effect on what happens.
Well, I guess if you want to put your money where your mouth is then, do you think there's going to be a Medivac?
No.
You think this is entirely misdirection?
Completely. Do you?
I'm not so sure. Because we get used to the editor's tricks by now. Like, they show... Because in Heroes vs. Villains, for instance, they showed probes coming to the camp when Boston Rob had his little private riders episode. And obviously that didn't really amount to anything. Like, looking at the next time on Survivor segment again, you could see... Well, at the end, when Jeff Post has that quote, where we only pull people from the game if it's serious or whatever, you can see Penner sitting there. And I couldn't tell whether Penner was the person who Post was talking to, or whether he was talking to someone else and Penn was just blocking the shot?
Well, Gary pointed out, I think, he said, keep an eye on Jeff Kent's knee because he was a durable player for 17 years and he would not complain about this if it wasn't a big deal. And Gordon said professional athletes know their body better than anyone else. So if it's anyone, I think it would be Jeff Kent. I don't think it's going to be Jeff Kent. I don't think it's going to be anyone.
Yeah. One of the reasons we said that Colton was certainly not getting medevac last in the one world, and great call on that, by the way, both of us, is that his edit to that point had been one of the big ones of the season and that it wouldn't make sense for it to end like that. But now that we have that precedent, I can see a well-developed character like Penner or Jeff Kent being taken out and it not be a complete surprise.
That's totally true. I don't think it's completely out of the realm of possibility. I just don't buy it.
And also, and I guess one final note is that my heart would break for Penner if he was medevaced again.
That would be so brutal.
I mean, I would laugh at it on a kind of cheap, cruel level, but at the same time, it would have to be heartbreaking for the guy.
Yeah, that would be terrifying. Yeah, so Dom, I think I'm good for this week.
Yeah, so not much more to add other than that, as we said at the top, the both parts of the Coscast should be up pretty soon, the Big Brother review that we did, and that was a lot of fun to do, so we hope you enjoy that. Other than that, we don't have any guests lined up in the near future, although I guess we can work on changing that. So it's just going to be our weekly Survivor coverage as usual, so join us back again next week. Hopefully you're listening to this pretty soon after the episode. We're recording this Saturday morning for me, Friday evening for Colin, so this should be up Saturday afternoon for you guys, I guess, if you're listening in the US. So, like we said, we're hoping to increase the margins between when we record and when this gets up before the episode. But, yeah, until next time, I guess, see you next week.
Yeah, take care, everyone.